this room that I'm recording in. It's undergone a metamorphosis. Not quite as metamorphosy as a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. There's no way you can recreate that effect of Mother Nature just by taking some shit up off the floor and getting rid of the wheelie bin and putting an old desk in here and putting a bed in here and making it look like a spare bedroom that you make podcasts in. No, I can't make that look like something Mother Nature did. I do not seek to compete with Mother Nature. Admittedly, this is the room in the house where I am at my most creative, unless you count the sitting room where I make matchstick cats, which I do, I suppose. And this desk used to be out there and it's in here, so I'm using that now. Even then, in this room where I'm at my most creative, I can never, ever, ever reproduce the work of Mother Nature. If Mother Nature were to transform this room, she would say, oh, look, that's a caterpillar. Well, transform that into a beautiful butterfly. I'll cut off 96 of its legs. Well, otherwise, most of the stuff I'll do will be an improvement. I'll cut off Oh, wait, is that a centipede? Does a caterpillar have 100 legs? Oh, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't. That would make sense. I was wondering about that. Because if you're Mother Nature and you come along saying, I'm going to turn this centipede into a miracle of nature, I'll turn it into a butterfly, but that involved amputating 96 of its legs, that would seem like a downgrade. Maybe Mother Nature wouldn't think of it as that. Well, no, that makes sense. That's not a centipede, it's a caterpillar that gets turned into a butterfly. So no, I suppose that's reasonable. Of course, if Mother Nature, if she wasn't so obsessed with image, the last thing she would be doing would be turning it into a butterfly, because a butterfly is just making it look pretty. Now, I know Mother Nature has a system whereby if you have a butterfly that looks pretty, that attracts wasps or something, and that's how you create flowers or something like that, whatever it is. Petals on the flower look nice. They attract the local insects or whatever it is. Mother Nature is using that prettiness for some practical purpose involving survival of the species. I know that. But if she got a centipede and she turned that into a butterfly, that would involve amputating about 96 of the centipede's legs. Now, I know a centipede doesn't have 100 legs. It has a lot of legs and it was named a centipede because it seems like a loss. That's all. I know. I understand that. Well, it does have a lot of legs. Or at least has an image of having a lot of legs. How you be taking that away from it? You damn well better be replacing the 100 legs with something much better then, if you're going to do that. She probably knew damn well, Dave, you got a centipede, took off all his legs. You better damn well make the wings very, 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 very fancy, if that's going to be any substitute for having a 100 legs, or having enough legs that it looks like you might have 100. Now, having 100 legs, of course, in real life, if you're an insect with 100 legs, insects lived for a day or two. They have much shorter lifespans than us humans and other animals because they live life in the fast lane. They get everything done in a day or two and then they die. Now, a centipede that's operating 100 legs, that's going to live even less. It's going to have an even shorter lifespan because it's about heartbeats. The smaller the animal, the more heartbeats you use up in a day. If you're operating 100 legs as well as all that, imagine how many heartbeats that would use up. No, a centipede wouldn't last more than a couple of hours in the real world. So that would be a reason to have them metamorphosize into a butterfly or something after a couple of hours. But that's not what she does, Mother Nature. It's the caterpillars she turns into butterflies, not the centipedes. So none of that applies. So I got that wrong. Mother Nature got a lot of things wrong too. If you're listening to this from inside a black hole, now you might be thinking, why would I be listening to this from inside a black hole? Well, maybe our whole known universe exists inside a black hole. Has that occurred to you? It probably hasn't. If our whole known universe is located inside a black hole, then we're all in it together. I'm in it with you. We're all in the same boat. And whatever may happen, it's like that Billy Joel song. It's a Billy Joel song. It's not we're all in it together, but he says we'll all go down together. Don't worry, it's not vulgar. He goes, and we will all go down together. Now, I say it's not vulgar, but it's about war. And I would say war is vulgar. So maybe that's vulgar in that way, but not in the other way that you might have been imagining, or that I'm pretending to think that you might have been imagining. No, it's not like that. No, suffice to say, if we're all inside a black hole, then we're all in this shit together. Unless it's like, well, it depends. How do you... We don't really know what a black hole is. Us mere mortals who don't spend our days in a science lab with pipettes and burettes figuring out what a black hole is. No, we don't. For all we know, a black hole could be just like a window. So if we all say we're all in this black hole together, that's meaningless. Just means we're all at the other side of the window. That doesn't mean anything. If the window is a giant window in the side of our universe, then that means nothing. We can't say we're all in this together. No, we're not in anything together. We're all on the same side of the lens. It's meaningless. But if the black hole was a little small thing and we're all inside it, like it's a washing machine window or something. I've just made a terrible mistake. These new plastic bottles, they've changed the plastic bottle regime in this country. They're determined to make sure that we don't accidentally destroy the planet or something. So they've redesigned them so that when you open the top of a bottle, the bottle lid stays attached to the bottle by means of a little strip of plastic that remains attached. I've absentmindedly just separated this cork entirely from the bottle, broken off that little plastic thing. So now I don't have the benefit, which most of us didn't have this benefit until about 6 months ago. We went for most of our lives having never enjoyed this benefit, but we've gotten used to it very quickly, I can tell you. I don't have the benefit of the top remaining attached to the bottle while I drink from the bottle, so I don't have to worry about losing the bottle top. So it's just like living back in the old days up till 6 months ago before they made this compulsory on all bottles in this country. Just like being back in the dark. Oh Christ, what's that? Another deeper problem. I absentmindedly picked a bottle at random from the kitchen. Is it some water that's being infused with some sort of floral thing or some nonsense? Something that water shouldn't smell. Water shouldn't be infused with a hint of something. I'm not opposed to putting flavouring in water, but the flavour should be a proper thing where you get a you get a cordial and you put half a bottle of cordial in with the water. It shouldn't be a hint of fucking perfume or something. No, that's gross. I'm not going to drink that until I get to the point where my mouth is falling off. Which it shouldn't be yet, because I've just finished my coffee, so my mouth shouldn't be falling off yet. Although admittedly, caffeine does dehydrate you. But no, I'm going to hold off on that for now. Anyway. We're all in the same black hole together. If the black hole turns out to be just like a window, or like a window on a washing machine, then perhaps we're in the washing machine together. Well, no, if the black hole is just a big, huge lens, we're all in one side of it, that's meaningless. We're barely even neighbours, if that's the case. See, you wouldn't say, we're all in this universe together. That's ridiculous. That's like saying the person 3 miles down the road is your neighbour. They're not. Even if you're in one of these rural communities where everyone's house is 3 miles from the house next door, that's not your neighbour. No. For one thing, most of that land is probably farming land. Therefore, it's a business. If you're in an office in the city centre, you don't think of the people working the office in the building at the other end of the block as neighbours. No, you think of those as other people who commute to the city every day. So you don't think of people on the farm next door as neighbours. No, they own those fields because it's a business. They're there to make money. They're there to squeeze every ounce out of that land. They come up every year and they say, here's a bit of land. We grew turnips on it last year. So this year we'll grow daffodils, and then next year we'll grow limes. The year after that we let the cows eat the grass, And then the year after that, we'll grow turnips again and start the cycle again. That's how they do land like that. Each use takes different nutrients out of the soil, so you rotate it so everything gets put back in somehow and then it's ready to use again. These places where they grow these crops, they're treated exactly the same way as the landfill where you go to dump everything, these landfills. There was one near Bray in County Wicklow, a town near which I've lived for most of my adult life. Well, for 15 years, I lived about an hour and 20 minutes from there. That's the furthest I've lived from it. And even then, it was reasonably well accessible by motorway. We had no use for that. You don't go using dumps in someone else's county. That's just rude. I think I'm ready for that water now. Yeah, it's not as bad as I'd feared. Anyway, these dumps, they spent 10, 20 years filling the dumps up with domestic rubbish. Every day, lorries turn up and empty all this crap into it. Literally called a landfill. They're filling up the land. They're really filling up the air space above the land. Usually they'll situate it in some kind of a valley or something that they want to fill in. Or maybe that used to be a quarry. They've taken out all the stone and now they're going to replace all the stone with crap that came from your bin. So they do that. And then they build houses or something on top of it. Then they wait another couple of 100 years till the houses all fall down and the people die inside them. And then they turn it into a cemetery. And then they keep that as a cemetery for maybe 500 years. Or until nobody cares anymore. And then they de-sanctify the cemetery and they'll turn it into wherever it's going to be next, I don't know. If they leave it long enough, I suppose they could turn it into an archaeological place. If an archaeological dig and they go, oh look, we found these remains in this place, that's the dinosaur. It's a strange looking dinosaur, I'll admit, because it's all basically just bones and it's not even that. Wait. Dinosaur fossils are not the same as dinosaur bones, if I remember rightly. If I understand correctly, a dinosaur fossil is just basically the negative space around the dinosaur bone. Basically the rock from around the bone. It's basically an empty space. When someone tells you, you found fossils of this dinosaur, they're telling you they found an empty space around where the dinosaur's bones used to be. Is that right? Maybe it isn't. I don't know. When you go to a museum and they've rebuilt a dinosaur skeleton from scratch, they fill in the gaps with fake bones, I presume. Just like on a human. They can replace your shoulder now with an artificial ball thing that goes into the socket. And yeah, quite good movement on it. As long as you still have your muscles and your blood and your flesh and your everything else around it. Now, if you, as if I'm going to have a point to make from all this, I don't have a point to make. I'm searching. I'm reaching and searching and trying to find something to talk about here. It's not going very well. I was trying to make some clever thing about having a 5-year cycle on farmland with different uses every year. And then for some reason, I was going to compare that to a landfill site. Say that's exactly the same. Where they grow your food is exactly the same as what they do with the dump. That's just stupid. That's a stupid point to make, isn't it? Stupid point to make. There used to be a place near that dump I mentioned in Bray. You used to drive up to there. There was a road called Old Connor Avenue that goes up from the north end of that town over the motorway and up a bit. And you go up there, you get about a mile up there, and at a certain time of the year, you get about a mile up there, and suddenly you'd smell something disgusting in the air. It'll get into your car. You can close all the windows if you want. The smell still gets in. You have to hold your breath for about a mile and drive fairly fast. And that's called silage. And you're not allowed to complain about that because that's the normal smell of part of the farming process, we're told. We're told that there's a process in farming whereby your whole village for several weeks of the year has to smell like really, really, really raw, unprocessed shit. And that's perfectly natural. And the reason it's perfectly natural is because they got this really, really raw, unprocessed shit. It smells worse than the shit that you put in your toilet this morning before you flush it. I presume they lay it out over the fields or something and they just leave it there for a month. And I don't think they go and pick it up at the end of the month or anything. I think it just disintegrates. It's like if you shot in the middle of your sitting room and just left it for a month. And that's considered part of the process of farming. It's perfectly normal. Just goes away after a month or something. I don't know. Maybe that makes it easier. When a cat shits in somewhere where they're not supposed to shit, if you just leave it for a while, it gets firmer and it gets easier to pick up. I don't mean pick up with your hands, pick up with a plastic bag or a shovel or something. So maybe that's what they're doing. They're putting out this soilage all over the town. You never see where they put it. You just drive through a village and you get the smell. And you go, oh Christ, let's get out of here. In fact, I spent a night in a village like that once. There was an Amish village in Pennsylvania in America. My brother and I spent a night in a motel. We went out and walked towards the village and there was a smell everywhere. Now, I was led to believe that that was a normal part of the Amish life or something. That there's a smell everywhere, something to do with horses. I might have been lied to. Maybe that was just soilage. I don't know if you have soilage in America. Or if Amish people do soilage or their animals do soilage. In fact, I've never heard anyone from outside of my country, which isn't even on the same continent as America, mention soilage. So maybe that's just a local thing here. And maybe that was just a shitty village, or I don't know. What's my point? I don't know. I have another go at this water. It's tolerable because it's fizzy. I don't normally drink fizzy water, but the fact that it's fizzy has made the fact that it tastes like flowers or something somewhat tolerable. So that's good. That's good. At least it won't go to waste. We don't waste water then here. We don't waste water. We either drink it or we use it to flush the toilets, or we wash, or we use it in the dishwasher, or we use it in cooking, or we use it. What else do we use water for? We power our showers with water. Our showers are 100% powered by water. Well, I don't mean they use hydraulic power. No, in fact, they're not powered by water at all. What am I talking about? That's nonsense. No shower is powered by water. Unless perhaps you're in the North Pole or something and you have no electricity. You have some sort of generators that are powered by hydraulics. Is that a thing? Maybe it is. I don't know. Are hydraulics powered by water? I'm not sure. Actually, no, that's nonsense as well. Because you have aeroplanes where they use hydraulics to move the stuff around. You press a button on the dashboard and it uses hydraulic power to move something at the other end of the plane. No, that's nonsense. So no, hydraulics. Well, the clue's in the word hydraulics, hydro, which comes from hydroelectric, presumably. And the electric part comes from electricity. And the electricity part comes from city. Electricity on its own is of no use to anyone. You get an electric car on its own, that's of no use to anyone. Has to have something that you do with the electricity. And you go to someone, here's an electric car. Oh great, what am I supposed to do with that? Switch it on and enjoying the light from it. If that is, use it to read by. If you put it in my driveway with the headlights pointing into my sitting room, and that'll light the house. Maybe the electricity, and that is cheaper than what's in the house. I don't know. I've never had an electric car. I've had one that has electrics in it. They get electricity from somewhere. They use it to power lights and the radio. In fact, if I understand correctly, the thing that starts an engine on a traditional car is powered by electricity or battery or something. A stored electricity on a battery. So when you put your key in and you're led to believe that this key is starting the car, it's not. The key isn't starting the car at all. You're turning the key, and turning the key supposedly is like pressing the button on a cigarette lighter. That can only be done with a key if you have a key that's the right shape to fit in there. Well, you can hotwire a car, of course. Depending on local laws, you can hotwire a car if it's allowed. It's a very sophisticated skill that these criminals have. Instead of using the key, they pull out these two wires and they rub the wires together, just like it would rub two sticks together, and eventually there's a spark and that starts the car. The wires aren't normally just sticking out, so I suppose there's some skill in accessing electric wires that are underneath a dashboard somewhere. I don't know. Surely, if you have all these electronics on a car, there are all these wires and things. We're supposed to believe that you have wires in a car that if you rub them together, that'll start the car. But that's okay. Your car isn't easily stealable because the wires are hidden somewhere in a locked cabinet. I don't know. We've a lot to get on with today. Items that need to be attended to. Issues that need to be addressed. Topics. Oh, topics. We've got lots and lots of topics. We're positively booming to the scenes with topics. We've got topics coming out of. Topics coming out of this setup. I've got a new setup here. I say a new setup. It's the same room I've been recording in. It's just not full of crap anymore. I've removed all the crap. I even removed the perfectly clean and appropriate indoor wheelie bin, which has been in here for many months, which I've discussed before, and for which I still maintain there's nothing wrong with having it in here. But I've removed that now. It's no longer a feature of this room. In fact, this room, it now looks more like a spare bedroom than anything else. It is a spare bedroom. It's a spare bedroom. I don't come in here to sleep, though. If I did come in here to sleep, I would not expect to have much success. Because when I come into the room, I've invariably had about 4 energy drinks and 8 mugs of instant coffee made with 2 or 3 spoonfuls of coffee in each. So I would not expect to have much sleep in the spare room were I to come in here expecting to have. Well, that makes no sense. I would not expect to have much sleep in here were I to come in here expecting sleep. Well, I think you know what I mean. I know what I mean anyway. If I know what I mean, then surely you should be able to know what I mean. If I can listen back to that and say, oh, I know what I meant by that, then you should be just as easily capable of doing that because you're listening to the same thing as I am. You're listening to my voice. I'm listening to my voice as it comes out of my head. So it's a bit more echoey than how you hear it, because I hear it echoing around my skull on its way out of my mouth. You don't hear it until it gets to your ears. But let's not get bugged down in the physics of it. We went into that last episode. I went into how there's an imbalance between podcaster and listener. Because the sounds and sentences are coming out of my mouth, but they're not going into your mouth. They're going into your ear, echoing around inside your brain, getting processed. And they're not ending up in your mouth, unless you're plagiarizing me. In this case, you're probably using AI to do that, so you're probably not even listening. So you're probably not. So no, there is an imbalance. And if you were to speak back to me in some way, yeah, you wouldn't be sending your reply out through your ears and then back into my mouth. No. You'd be communicating it through your mouth and expecting me to take a hint through my ears. That's like when they used to listen to something on the radio and then the listener would write a letter into the Broadcasting Corporation about the content. And they think that was the equivalent to say, oh, I'm going to make myself heard on this radio program by writing a letter. No, that's not how it works at all. That's like if you wrote a letter to a newspaper, but you sent it in audio format. Please reproduce this audio format in your printed newspaper. Which is not an unreasonable request if you happen to be unable to speak or you're deaf or something. Oh, wait, is it? Or the opposite? Oh, whatever. I don't know. If I want to write an audio book, I don't go and get out a microphone and start saying stuff. No, because that's not a book. That's not a book. That's a podcast. An audio book involves writing. Whether it ends up coming out of your mouth or not, you still get out your typing equipment and you write down all this shit. Then either you or a narrator reads it. So you type this out, you release it from your brain once, so it goes into this book that you've written, and then you go to make the audio book edition. You go back, you read your own shit all over again, and that's a good test. That's a proper test of an author. You get them to read their own shit into an audio book, and see if it makes sense. And half the time it doesn't. I listen to audiobooks all the time. They get the narrator on. They get the author to narrate his own words. And that's when you invariably find out that the author has used a lot of words that he doesn't really know how to say in real life. He just likes how they look like written down. Maybe because he's a connoisseur of the written word and not the spoken word. I suppose that's reasonable. But then don't narrate your own audiobook. Get someone else to narrate your audiobook. Don't fill your audiobook up with consonants that you're not willing or able to pronounce if you're going to read it yourself. Don't do that. Can you imagine if the listener read your audiobook or if they read your printed book and they said, I'm going to ignore all of the K's and C's. I'm going to disregard those when I'm reading this. Then they'd be reading a completely different book than the one that he wrote. But then you go and do that when you narrate your audiobook if you're one of those people who doesn't pronounce their K's and C's, even though you've written them. You go and read your book, you're reading a completely different book to the one that you wrote. And then you're misrepresenting yourself, probably confusing yourself as well. You're reading this and it's coming out different because you're not pronouncing all the consonants. You're saying, this doesn't look like something I'd write. Sounds like something I'd say, but it doesn't look like something I'd write. And that's when you realise you can't just write stuff down and then go, I can write this, I can speak it just as well as I can write it. It's exactly the same thing. No. That's like saying if I write a poem and perform it on my harmonica and vocals, it's exactly the same. No, it isn't. Anyway, I've got a new setup here. I don't have the wheelie bin in here anymore. I don't have the mess in here anymore. I have an L-shaped desk. It's a hand-me-down desk that I got from myself. It's an L-shaped desk, but it's not in the corner. And I highly recommend that. If you're going to get an L-shaped desk, best way to enjoy it is to put it not in a corner. It's in an alcove. It's in a corner, but the corner part isn't in a corner, if you know what I mean. The part of this corner desk that's designed not to be in a corner is in a corner, and the part that's meant to fit around the corner is protruding. I like it this way. It's great. It separates up the room a bit, marks out my territory here. For a cat were to come in here and look at this, he'd say, oh no, that's his territory there. I'm not going to stray in there, under there. No, no. I'll either respect that, although of course, in the case of a cat, respecting that might mean I'll fight him for it with my claws and by hissing. A cat would consider that respect. It's respecting the fact that you have a claim over this territory and it's going to fight you for it. So if a cat claws you like that, don't take it as disrespect. That's not disrespect. That's in fact respect. If the cat just comes in and thinks, oh no, he's nothing. He's no claim over any of this. I'm just going to sit on his lap and purr. That's a cat disrespecting you. That cat thinks you're nothing. Thinks you're nothing. It thinks you're just a piece of furniture. It's thinking, fuck this moron here. It's probably not even thinking that. Because cats don't think in pseudo-psychological words like that. Or pseudo-medical words like moron. I think moron is a medical term, is it? I'm not sure. It's often used as a term of abuse. A habit which I would like to get out of. Yeah, I'd like to stop calling people morons if I can at all. I don't like that way I use that. So I'm going to try and stop that, correct myself on that. Although to be fair, in this instance, in this segment, I was talking about the cat thinking I'm a moron, not the other way around. So the fictional cat, in fact, calling me a moron. Are we going to start challenging domestic cats on their use of pseudo-psychological, medical terminology in their own heads? I don't think that's reasonable. I don't think that's reasonable at all. Leave the cat out of this. Leave the cat. It's not the cat's fault. Huh. It's not the cat's fault. You can apply that to anything. Very little is the cat's fault. You go out for a walk now. Go for a 10-minute walk around your block. Or however long it takes to circumnavigate your block. I don't know. If it gets to 10 minutes and you're not home yet, you might need to go for another couple of minutes. Or if it gets to 10 minutes and you find you've just passed your house, you can either keep going and then it'll be an 18-minute walk perhaps. Or just turn back, and then it'll be maybe a 13-minute walk, and some of it'll have been a little repetitive. But most of it will have been good. That's all you can ask for in a recreational walk. It's not meant to be a recreational one, though, is it? No, you're doing it because I told you to go and walk around your block for some reason. Yes, I was saying, if you take a walk around your block right now, look at all the problems that you see and look at everything you see, like the problems, the potholes, the noise pollution, the fact that it's about to piss from the heavens, whatever else you see, the overpriced apartments for rent that nobody can afford, the advent of some hideous modern discount German supermarket opening up across the road that looks hideous and depressing. All of those problems that you see, make a list of them and then look at them and say how many of these can be blamed on a cat. And I think you'll find there's very few. Very, 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 very few. And that's all we're saying here. I've just realised that when you set up now has within reach one of those little plastic steps that women and one of my siblings use to reach the top of a wardrobe. And apparently the built-in wardrobe in the average domestic home in this country is made too high for any adult female or my sibling who's quite tall. There's a little plastic step, it's like a little stool and you stand on it. Gives you an extra 6 inches of height or so. Or maybe a bit more. You stand on this and that enables you to reach the top shelf of a wardrobe. Now, I was thinking about this yesterday. I went to throw something into my attic. The attic in this house has one of those fold-out ladders. You open the hatch, you pull down the hatch, and then you unfold this ladder, and then you climb up it. Now, yesterday I was just opening the hatch. I didn't want to fold down the ladder and climb up. I just wanted to throw something into the attic. I knew one issue you have when you throw things into an attic like that, especially if it's something soft and light enough to throw. There's a good chance that the first couple of times you throw it, it'll come back down to you. You have to do it again. So I was prepared for that. I think I got it up in 2 goes on this occasion. I did notice, though, worryingly, I've taken great pride in the fact that in this house, in which I've been accessing the attic since the 1990s, since my family first moved into it in the 1990s, and I've come and gone from this house. I've gone and come back, and I live here again now. I've always taken pride in the fact that I could reach the handle on that loft entrance without having to use this stupid, ridiculous pole that comes with it. There's a stupid, ridiculous pole that came with it. These stairs, there's an Irish brand called Styra. It's just the Irish for stairs. They make these folding attic ladders. It's a wooden thing. It looks like a homemade thing that a proper craft place would make in a cottage industry type thing somewhere, and they attach it to a loft entrance. They put a new loft entrance that's longer than the standard one, so there's enough for a ladder folded in 3 parts to fit attached to that. Anyway, they give you this little handle thing. It's a long piece of wood with a hook driven into one end of it. It's a standard type of hook that you get in the shop that you screw into the wall to hang keys on, and you're supposed to use that to grab the handle on the ceiling to open that door. I've taken great pride in the fact that I've never had to use that. Never ever had to use it. It's not that high. I can reach up on my tippy toes and reach that handle and pull it down. I've had workmen in here coming in to do work in the attic and they say, would you mind opening the loft thing? And I just reach up in front of them and show off and just grab the handle and pull it down. I'm not particularly tall. I'm no taller than, in fact, I would say I'm less tall than the average adult. I don't know. How tall is the average adult? I don't know. Last I measured myself or had myself measured, I was told it was 5'9.5". I don't think that's particularly tall, is it? No. I've never had any problem reaching the attic. Well, then yesterday I had a problem reaching the attic. Now, am I getting smaller? Surely to Christ I'm not getting smaller. I'm not elderly yet. I shouldn't be getting smaller for at least another 25 years. By my estimation, so there's no reason I should be getting smaller. But yesterday, for the first time ever, I felt the need to get up on the little stool before I could grab the handle of that loft thing and open it. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It makes sense to you, it probably doesn't. And not because I haven't explained it very well. Rest assured that if I did explain it to you properly, it would still not make sense. Anyway, I found the pole thing yesterday and the hook thing that's being attached to it for about 30 years is gone. I think it got broken last week when I was rearranging cat bathroom furniture. If you're any kind of a self-respecting householder with cats and you have a lot of cat litter trays, you get an enclosed thing. It's made to look like a cute little house that the cat goes into to shit. You've got a two-story setup on these cat bathroom things. They're very similar to what they had in St. Stephen's Green in Dublin a few months into the COVID lockdowns. Nobody was able to go for a piss in Dublin city centre. Retailers and restaurants and businesses didn't feel able to provide a safe public bathroom, and all of the proper public toilets closed down in the 90s. So they built temporary public bathrooms at two places in the city centre, and they remind me very much of these things. Cutesy wooden things, one sitting on top of the other. So any cat who wants to use the upstairs bathroom, there's no stairs. It's like if you put a prefab in a building site. You see these building sites, they put the site office in a building site and invariably they get some prefabricated offices and just stack them one on top of the other and they put some sort of stairs in. Well, it's like those, except they don't have a stairs, they have a stool. I don't mean a stool of the kind that the cat puts in the litter tray. No, a stool that you sit on. It's very similar to what happens with a doll's house. If you're a child and you have a doll's house and you want to access the top floor of the doll's house, don't force your head into the doll's house and go up through the stairwell and look up through the stairwell to examine the upstairs of the doll's house. No. You get stuck or injured or something. That'd be very dangerous. No. The whole back of the doll's house opens. Now, the cats don't open the whole back of the cat's bathrooms. In order to get to the entrance lobby of the upper one, which is completely independent of the lower one, they can just climb up on this stool and then go in through the normal cat exit on that. So that stool now doubles as my standing up on to reach the handle of the attic entrance, which I used to be able to reach. Should I measure myself? I don't think I will. I don't want to measure myself, see my shrinking. I'm not old enough to be shrinking. I know people start shrinking in their old age. I'm not old. I'm older than you perhaps, but I'm not old and I'm not old enough to be shrinking yet. Am I less flexible or something perhaps? Maybe there's that. Maybe my arms don't stretch out as much as they used to do. Maybe they're the same length, but the muscles don't stretch out. Perhaps from lack of use. I don't know. Maybe I'll start using that stationary bicycle. There's a stationary bicycle in this room now as well. That's the other thing. Oh, that's why I brought up the loft thing. There's a little stool in here now of the type that people who aren't tall enough to open things and wardrobes, they climb up on one of these. You take one step up and that's suddenly you're able to access everything in the upper part of the wardrobe. And there's one of these in here now. I've just discovered it. I've got my feet up on it. I do like the effect. It gives the effect that you're sitting higher up off the ground where you're almost like you're sitting at a reception desk rather than a standard office desk. It's like being up in the clouds above your desk. It gives the effect of being higher up when you're not really higher up because it's just my feet and my legs are higher up than they would otherwise be. So I've no contact with the ground at all now. I can't see the floor anyway. I can't see the surface of the floor. So when I'm up here now, I can imagine that I'm looking down on the floor from the clouds. All I see is the wooden floorboards. I don't see the surface of the boards themselves. I just see the colour. And it looks like foggy brown stuff down there. So, and it looks like my shoes are on the floor too. I've taken them off and it looks like they're way down there as well. Looks like if I was bombing my own shoes, this is what I would see from the clouds. I wouldn't be the pilot, of course, because pilots have to have proper eyesight. But perhaps if I was a passenger in a bomber that was bombing my shoes from up here. And that's that will make sense because I do have control panels up here. I have a tablet here in front of me, right in front of my face, up on a stand. It's very satisfying. I also have my phone on another stand right in front of me. Those are both up several inches above the desk. So it's very satisfying. I'm up here. It's like a little control thing up in the tower. A control tower. It's like being a crane operator. In fact, my microphone thing is up on the stand that could well be comparable to a crane. Now, why would a crane operator's dashboard have a crane sitting on it? I suppose that doesn't make sense. Well, it does in a way. It's like if you're in charge of a big cruise ship. It wouldn't be out of the question to have a little replica of the ship sitting in pride of place in the cockpit or wherever the captain hosts his special guests for dinner. You see that on Star Trek, Captain Picard, in his little officey thing. I think they call it a ready room, and he has a replica of a ship. That's appropriate on a spaceship, by the way. As if you're on a spaceship, you rarely see the outside of the spaceship while you're on a mission. This mission could be going on for years and years. You could forget what the outside of your ship looks like. You could be making very important plans about where you're going to go with that spaceship, and you forget what it looks like from the outside. You'd be going, we're going to bring the spaceship over there. Now, how will that look from outside? And everyone will go, I don't know. We don't go outside for obvious reasons. There's no air. We don't really go outside. I'm sure we can put on a spacesuit if necessary. And that's something that doesn't happen very often in Star Trek at all. Very, very rarely does someone put on a spacesuit and go out on the outside of the ship. It's considered very, very extravagant to make a television episode where someone goes outside into space in a spacesuit and walks along the surface of a ship that doesn't exist in real life. That's probably very expensive, so they don't do it very much. They don't do it very much at all. They don't. I suppose that's reasonable. Is that reasonable? It probably is. It probably is. Probably is. If you're listening to this in the bathroom at home, but you're working from home, if you're the average hard-working, self-employed, working-from-home person, I'll bet you go into the bathroom during your workday and you bring work with you. So you think, oh, I'm going to fill up my day with work, I'm going to be efficient, I'm going to get some work done in here. You probably have a little chest of drawers opposite your toilet in your bathroom at home. You employ to others that it's there to just keep toiletries, toilet rolls, maybe a biro and a book of crossword puzzles to do in there. But no, you use that for work. You bring a file in there and you do work on the toilet and you think you're great as a result, which I think is appalling. Those of us who've worked in offices, non-self-employed, we've worked in offices. If we go into the toilet cubicle in the day and try to spend as much time in there as possible, that would be considered irresponsible and unwork ethic-like. If we went in there and brought a file with us as well, that would be considered even worse. And that's why we wouldn't do it. But you're doing that at home and you think, because you're self-employed and you're your own boss, you think you're being great. No, you're not. You're being disgusting. Non-self-employed workers in an office block, we go into toilets. Well, I'm not employed anymore, but when I was, I would go into the... If I could get away with it at all, I would incorporate my toiletry routine into my day. Spend some time in the cubicle. You wouldn't bring files in there. That would be considered bad. I'd be afraid of being caught bringing files in there. That would be a bad thing. Someone will quite rightly say, what in the name of Christ are you bringing a customer's files into the toilets for? No, you wouldn't do that. Instead, you'd do the semi-responsible thing. You'd go in there and waste time in there if you consider doing your ablutions to be wasting time. If you listen to a podcast or something, you wouldn't work in there. No. So it'd be considered even worse. But no, you think you're great at home in your home bathroom that you think is an office within an office. It's not. You've been watching that movie Panic Room and you think, oh, look, this bathroom is like a panic room in a way, in that it's an extra. Your house is supposedly, your modern house is built securely the perimeter is locked. You keep your perimeter secure. You have your windows and doors locked and maybe some alarms on the windows and doors. So the perimeter is what you keep locked, and the inside of the house, you're free to wander around safely. But you think when you go into your bathroom has to be like a panic room. It has to be a fortress within a fortress that itself is locked. So you put this bolt on the bathroom door that you think is there for extra security. It's not. Those bolts are not for security. They're for privacy. They're to stop someone who you live with seeing or smelling something that you wouldn't want them to see or smell. That's what those are for. They're nothing to do with security. You think if you go into that fortress within a fortress and you bring in some work because you're one of these big fancy self-employed work from home self-starters and you think I'm going to spend 15 minutes of my day in there in the bathroom during my work day. I'm going to bring some files in with me and work on my customers' files. And it's perfectly fine because that's a fortress within a fortress. It's a secure place to bring work. It's not like I'm taking it away from the office and bringing it to somewhere less secure or doing it in a public park or something. No, it's even more secure. That's what you think. Well, it's not. It might be more private. It's not more secure. And it's private in a bad way because at least if you're working on a customer's files in a public part of the office, and other customers and staff can come in and see you working on that. At least there's openness. There's openness about that. You can be secure and open, but you're doing it privately. You could be up to no good with those files. Well, I suppose you couldn't. I just find it a bit weird that you're self-employed and working from home and you're so fucking weird about it. You want to get work done on the toilet. Yet those of us who are supposedly not self-starters and we're more reliant on corporations to feed us. We go into these offices, we try to build a shit into our workday, but we would never dream of bringing work into that toilet with us because that would be considered irresponsible and not what you do. But you think you're great because you're doing it, because you're your own boss. You can decide what is or isn't great. So that's nonsense. That's just cheating. That's nonsense. Now, it's also nonsense. This is the second time I've said all this stuff about toilets. Because the first time I wasn't recording, and the first time I said it, it took about 12 minutes. And now it's taking less than 6. So either I was adding loads of unnecessary extra crap the first time, or I've forgotten a lot of what I said the first time that made it, I thought, worth repeating after I realised I wasn't recording. I don't know. Suffice to say, no, your panic room that you think you have in your bathroom, it's not a panic room at all. That's what you think it is. These panic rooms that we all only know from that movie about 20 years ago called Panic Room, it's about this woman and I think her young child. They had a panic room in their house. A panic room was something none of us knew until that moment. We all learned it from this movie. Or at least from hearing about this movie, we thought, oh, we saw a poster advertising a movie and suddenly we all knew about the concept of a panic room. We'd never heard of it before. And we didn't even have to watch the movie to find out what a panic room it was. You watch this movie trailer and suddenly you've learned what a panic room is, whether you're interested in going to see the movie or not. That's when movies were educational. You got free education out of that. You didn't even have to go to see the movie. If it's a proper movie poster, maybe you're standing at a bus stop and you'd see this poster and it'd be a picture of some woman inside a house. I don't know what posters they had, but presumably they were self-explanatory. And you go, oh, right, there's things called panic rooms and rich people have them in their houses. Your perimeter of your house is supposed to be secure, locked and all. But you had this extra room in the middle of your house just in case something happened whereby people got into the secure area of your house. You had to have an extra secure area. And basically, it was locking yourself into this room where no one else could get in and you'd hide from them. Now, these people had managed to get into your house, but you're now going to trust that they're going to not get into your panic room, which is just another layer of security. I don't know about that. Maybe your panic room is built of some sort of metal whereby You get into your panic room and you press the lock button, and then an element heats up and melts all the metal that the doors are made of, and the metal door and the metal wall all melts into one and then solidifies, so there's no exit until, I don't know, what you expect to happen then. How do you get out? Maybe you just don't expect to get out. I don't know. Those people are just going to stand there waiting to see how you get out. That's the thing there. If I was an intruder in a house that had a panic room like that, I'd be so fascinated as a kidnapper that I'd just lose all interest in trying to profit from this. I just want to see what goes on. Perhaps I had some interest in kidnapping you or something. Perhaps you're the wife and child of a very rich billionaire or something. And I'd planned to get into your house. Me and my criminal gang managed to get into your house, and then we realised you were going into a panic room that was so sophisticated that you press a button after you go in, and then it heats up the metal, and the metal door and the metal wall all melt into one solid mass. You're locked in this unreachable metal room now. I'd forget about wanting to extort any money from you or your billionaire husband after kidnapping you. And I just see out of sheer curiosity what's going to happen next. I want to see, are you going to just stay in there and hope I'll leave before you run out of air? Or are you hoping I'll leave and then somehow you'll make contact with the outside world who'll come and free you somehow? Or are you just going to wait until the outside temperature goes down enough for the metal to no longer hold its integrity? Which, I don't know, maybe there is something like that. I presume you have a plan of some sort. I justify it to myself by saying, oh, even if I don't make any money out of this particular criminal project that I'm on now, think of it as a learning exercise. So I learn stuff for future burglaries or whatever. So that's how I would justify that. In fact, I think that would be even more justified than you sitting on your toilet working on the customer file at home or in the office. And you go, oh no, this is going to be an unexpected in-job training, not in-house training. Well, in your house, I suppose. It's not my house. I'm the intruder. Of course, the modern house, ironically, the cheaper the house, the more secure some of the bathrooms are. Before you even build a panic room, they're somewhat secure. It's still just a bathroom with a privacy bolt on the door. They're not going to sort like Fort Knox or anything. But the cheaper houses, the bathrooms are going to be these tiny ensuite bathrooms that are designed in a part of the house where there's no windows. And that helps. They put a lot of these modern houses now, but they're putting in a three-bedroom house, and they're putting in an ensuite bathroom into one of the bathrooms. The main bathroom will be on the perimeter of the house because you have to have a window on that. So the main bathroom is literally on the perimeter of the house, or has a window that's part of the outer perimeter of the donut. But then they'll have an ensuite bathroom in one of the bedrooms, usually the master bedroom. And because of the way houses are designed, they'll have to put that kind of behind the main bathroom to be near the plumbing. But it won't have its own window, but it's kind of wedged in between the bathroom and the bedroom to which it's the ensuite bathroom. So this ensuite bathroom will be arguably more secure than the main bathroom, especially in a not-so-fancy house. These ensuites, they're basically wardrobes that you shit into these days. They don't have a window. They have some sort of vent. They have an air vent system that switches itself on automatically when you switch on the light for the ensuite. Because there's no windows. They assume you're going to switch on the light. And when you switch on the light, the fan thing comes on and keeps the air somewhat tolerable. They know you're going to go in there, have a big long shit and stink up the place. The last thing they want you to be doing is to not have ventilation. Even though the first thing they cheap out on when they're building it is the window thing, which would help enormously with the ventilation. Say, no, this is a cheap family home in an estate, a semi-detached home. We're not going to put windows on these little ensuite bathrooms, but we will have compulsory fans so you don't sue us for poisoning everybody. Of course, a normal podcaster could turn this into a succinct point about where this country is headed in terms of socio-political matters. I just realised this morning there's a presidential election on today in this country I'd forgotten about. Now, that's not to say I'm being irresponsible and not thinking about voting, no. I just mean I hadn't obsessed about it every day like I used to with these things. I hadn't gone on Twitter this morning and read all the latest presidential election stuff. I haven't spent a week combing the newspapers. No, I knew there was an election on. I made my decisions and then I forgot about it. You don't need to be thinking about these things all day, every day. No, you won't be thinking about these things all day, every day. Just as you do when you're using a toilet, you allocate yourself some time and then you go and do it. And when it's done, you wash your hands and it's done. And then, you know, I'll probably have to do that again in another day or two. Yeah, plan for that. Hopefully make it a regular schedule thing. In this country, every 7 years, you allocate some time to think about what you're going to do regarding your presidential election voting decisions. And then you make your decision and then you forget about it again until the next time. You have a cycle. And that's the way it should be. Don't become obsessed with these things. You might think, oh, if news is bad for you, how about I listen to fake news instead? Or maybe I get a balance of fake news and real news. Or else I'll find some other way to work the system. I'll game the system so it works for me somehow. Everything's all AI now. You're probably AI listening to this, and I'm probably AI saying this. I don't even know what I'm talking about, so it's very likely that I'm AI. Are you AI as well? Maybe you are. Maybe you don't exist. Maybe you're just some bot that's been sent by Google to find out what this podcast is so you can ignore it and put it down the bottom of the search results page. That's probably what you are. Most of the listeners to this are probably bots. And I don't mean that as an insult to you, no. It's impossible to insult you. You're a program. If you're not a program, this isn't about you. In most houses, your ensuite bathroom with no window that's just off your master bedroom is the nearest thing you have to a panic room. Now, I did panic in that ensuite in my last house once because, well, for a while, I was after I'd left the ensuite. Ironically, I'd left this non-panic, this ensuite full thing and gone downstairs and saw a dampness in the ceiling just under where the ensuite is. Now, if that's not a panic room, I don't know what is. It's literally pissing itself. There was water from the shower leaking out. It was a cracked tile somewhere. It was causing a problem with the ceiling downstairs. So I suppose in a way that's a panic room in the wrong way. I suppose the downstairs room that has a ceiling that's on display, that's like an interface with the panic room. It's like a screen showing, here's some things you need to panic about. Here's a graph showing the amount of dampness spreading under the ceiling from that fucking shower of gobshites who built that badly built ensuite. But the shower itself wasn't leaking. How do I think about her? Oh, was it? Wait. Maybe it was. The tiles were cracked. I found out the hard way that when you get tiles put in a wet room of some sort, in a bathroom, on an upstairs wooden floor, and he saw a crack in that thing and you're just fucked. That's when you learn what tiles are for. That's what the problem was. I didn't realise what tiles were for until then. I thought they were just there to look nice. But no, they're there to hold all the water in until it can flow out through an unnatural outlet such as a drain. You don't want the water to naturally flow out of the room through the porous wooden floor, so you put tiles in. And then you put these tiles in. You would think that if tiles are there to make a room watertight, you would imagine the proper way to do it would be to make the whole floor one tile. And not have a load of tiles that have gaps between them that are filtering with mushy stuff. That seems ridiculous to me. Or else if they have stuff that they put between the tiles to keep the space between them tight, make the whole floor out of that. Don't use tiles at all. Use whatever that stuff is, the grout. Because apparently the grout is great. You can put all lines between the tiles. You can have a grid of lines where the gaps between the tiles, that's just grout, and that's apparently considered as good as a tile. So just have the whole floor be grout. Forget about the tiles completely. Because the grout won't crack as easily as the tile will. If tiles are better than grout, then make the whole floor one big tile. If they're that great. But you won't, because you know damn well that thing's going to crack. Make the whole floor grout then. Is that what it's called? The stuff, the adhesive stuff. It's adhesive, but it's also between the tiles, so presumably it's as good. What are tiles made out of? I suppose they're made out of tile. Is that what the stuff is called? Tile? I don't know. Wait, are they called tiles because they're in your toilet? Surely not. Anyway, if you're listening to this inside the donut of a panic room equipped house, by that I mean you're in the donut meat of the house. That probably needs some explaining, and therefore is not much use. If you're in the business, you and I, of designing panic rooms and installing them, or designing houses with panic rooms, we would probably have a vocabulary that we use to describe these, just as any other profession has its own vocabulary. So we would probably have a word for the meat of the house, the meat of the donut of the house, and by that I mean the area between the perimeter of the house and the perimeter of the panic room. And I would call that the meat of the donut. We'll call that the donut for short. If I was in a business involving manufacturing and designing and installing panic rooms, it would have a name for that part of the house, I would think. I would assume in the design process, you'd call that the donut area or something like that. And then when you're referring to the panic room, you might call that the super secured area or something. Although if the people who were designing the house originally before it had a panic room were, at least the people who were installing the locks and the alarms on the outside perimeter of their house were probably thinking of the whole house as being secure. And they weren't thinking, oh, this is the donut area with a bit in the middle that's like a, it's not part of the house and is therefore more secure. No, they weren't thinking like that. But of course, if they had been thinking properly, you panic room installers wouldn't be needed at all. You are needed because they fucked up. Or maybe they just aren't designing for that intense an experience. People who normally are designing houses, they're not designing them for billionaires whose family are about to get kidnapped while they're out of work. No. They're just designing a normal house with a normal anti-burglary system that controls the perimeter and allows you to move freely within your own house without having to worry about whether you need to lock yourself in the bathroom in case there's intruders in the rest of the house. No. No. I suppose it's serving a different need. It's not fair to refer to the people who designed the original periphery of the house as incompetent. Just because you come along later when you're designing a panic room, which is for increased security needs of that house. No, you're serving a different purpose. So I hope you recognise that and not be so insincere as to accuse the original designers of the house as being incompetent. Just as they wouldn't accuse you of being incompetent, but that's mainly because you're not. You've no reason to. Well, as far as they know, how would they know? They don't come back later to see what you've done with your panic room installation. Unless they've, why would they? They were involved in the original design of the house. You came along later when the new owners had extra needs that weren't catered to by the original security design team. Why would they come back later and have a look at that? No, no reason they would do that. Unless, I suppose, whoever owned the house who had the panic room installed then later sold on that house. And the next people who came along decided, oh, this building used to belong to billionaires who needed a panic room. We don't need a panic room anymore. So we'll get the normal periphery security people in and tell them we just want to strip this back down to being a normal secure house with a secured periphery, burglar alarm and external doors and windows secured. And we want to get rid of whatever that thing is in the middle of the house. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? Does it make sense to you? If it does, that's great. Unfortunately, it doesn't make any sense to me, at least not in the way where I can run with it as a topic on which I expand. No. I suppose that's the whole point of the panic room things. They're specialists. You can't come back later and critique their work. No. Just as when you drive a car to the airport and you park the car and then you come back from wherever you've been and then you get back into your car and you start driving. If you see an aeroplane up in the sky above you, you don't say, oh, that pilot, he's not driving that properly at all. I've just been to the roundabout there and I signalled properly. I moved into the inner lane until I got to my turn off of the roundabout and then I did my correct signal then and moved out. That pilot just flew straight over it like it doesn't exist. No, you can't say that. So it's the same when you're the people designing the external alarm system and you're talking about the specialists who installed the panic room. It's a whole different thing. Maybe on the same overlay and that if you were to look down on a map from straight overhead and you saw the pilot flying over on a little picture of a pilot and a plane flying over that roundabout and the car underneath, it would look like it's just an overlay over the same map. But you all know there's more to it than that. Two cats walk into a bar. One of the cats says, hello, can I have a pint of your finest vodka, please? And the man behind the bar says, certainly, sir, a pint of my finest vodka coming right up. That'll be 180 euros, please. The cat says, that seems like a lot. And the barman says, yes, vodka isn't typically sold in pints in a bar establishment. It's sold by the measure. And the cat says, a pint is a measure, isn't it? The barman says, no, it's not. It's an old measure left over from long, long ago in the dark ages before we all moved to metric, for one thing. But also, vodka is measured in yards, isn't it? Vodka is measured in yards. Wait, is that right? Is vodka measured? Something's measured in yards. They go a yard of ale or a yard of... Something's measured in yards or distance or something like that in the world of bar husbandry. Is that what it's called, bar husbandry? I don't know. Running a bar. Isn't there something that's measured by the yard? I don't think it's just ale. There's a yard of something. If they're selling it by the yard, that's in a very, 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 very narrow bottle. Because a yard of beverage in a normal glass or bottle would be gallons and gallons of liquid. I know you Americans, you buy a jug of beer and gallons of beer in that. You'll have 12 students go into some bar somewhere, probably Harvard, where all your students go. You go into some bar in Harvard on a sunny Sunday afternoon, you go up to some bar and you sit outside in the beer garden to have a big jug of beer. It's probably got ice in it, has it? You probably pour a bucket of ice into it. Or you put the jug inside a bucket of ice. I don't know. Suffice to say, I've seen you Americans do this. You don't like having your own personal beer unit. No, you don't want the responsibility. Because for one thing, you know, there's going to be people in that group who are driving and who have chosen not to drive because they're being the designated driver. So they're not going to drink any of that. You don't want them to feel left out or you don't want them to feel isolated or you don't want them to ruin everyone else's day. You don't want to have to keep noticing this fella who's not drinking because he's going to have to drive you home because you'll be pissed. Your neck will be inside out. You'll be so pissed in a couple of hours. You don't want to have to keep thinking about your friend there who's very kindly chosen not to drink any alcohol at all. You don't want to have to think about the fact that he's doing that for you. And that's why you have the big jug there and you just imagine everyone drinking a bit out of it. That's where the thing of having the jug inside a bucket of ice comes in. If there's enough space between the jug and the bucket, then the fella who's not drinking alcohol can just dip his glass into that and get some ice out of it. After a while, there'll be water in there as well. If he wants water, he can just get that. And it looks like he's just dipping into the general jug. Of course, it's fooling nobody. It's fooling nobody. But things start to fool you more when you're drinking, so it'll fool you after a while. Or else you get to the point where you don't really give a shit about your friends anymore. So there's that as well. So that's the advantage of that, I suppose. But the disadvantage is that it tastes like piss. Your beer tastes like piss when you do it like that. Especially when you use beer that's not nice, which you're probably going to be doing. So no, don't do it like that. Get a pint glass. Get your barman to fill it up with whatever you're drinking. If you're the designated driver, you can fill it up with something nice and fizzy and non-alcoholic. if you're not the designated driver, get him to fill it up with something nice and alcoholic and not fizzy that tastes not like piss. Maybe something classy. Get this pint glass, fill it up with something classy. Something classy. What's classy that you can put in a pint glass? It's not beer. Cider isn't classy. So, not cider. Vodka. The classiness of vodka or otherwise depends upon the quantity you're drinking. If you're putting that in a pint glass, then you're just going to look ridiculous. Because it'll just look like water. It looks like, oh, that fella is drinking a whole pint of water. Absolute cheapskate. At least put some vodka in that water. And you can argue all vodka has water in it. In fact, every alcoholic beverage is brewed or distilled using water as part of the process. Even beer. Beer has water in it. My father used to make homebrew. He used to make homebrew in the back of the garage. You get a can of stuff, I don't know what it is, but some sort of homebrew thing. And you get a sachet of yeast or something. And then you get 8 gallons of water. And you boil stuff up on the hob for several hours in the evening that stinks. And then you pour that into something. And then you pour some other stuff into that. And then you let it sit in the press in the garage for several weeks. I missed a step. After you boil it up on the hob, you put the 2 buckets into the hot press, 2 huge 4-gallon buckets of newly boiled beer and water. You put that in the hot press for several days and then you bottle it in the garage. Now, the kit is only supposed to make 4 gallons, but if you're a responsible adult like my father was, you make 8 gallons out of that. Or it's barely alcohol at all, it's basically just piss. And he turned it into piss later, but it was piss to begin with. Tasted like piss, I presume. I've never tried it, but I was a child. You don't drink beer when you're a child. You do not. The last thing a child needs to be drinking is beer. For one thing, it doesn't taste nice. Children only like stuff to taste nice. Anything that tastes not nice is wasted on them. When they're a teenager then, you go, here's your first taste of beer. And then you have your first taste of beer and you go, oh, that's disgusting. That's absolutely fucking disgusting. I have 10 cans of that and then I'll vomit everywhere. And then next week I'll have another 10 cans and I'll vomit in less places than I did. Because I'm learning, I'm getting the hang of this. And then you'll move up to 16 cans and then you'll vomit a bit more. You learn to control your vomiting. That's what being a teenager is about. It's about controlling quantities and consequences. You learn about quantities and you learn about consequences. And then you learn to adjust. You adjust your quantity or adjust your consequences. You learn all about adjustment. Adjustment. Was there a thing called the Adjustment Bureau? I think it was. Was there some kind of science fiction movie? The Adjustment Bureau. What did they do? I don't know. Probably something along the lines of one of those weird movies that are all based on something that Philip K. Dick wrote on drugs in the 1940s. That will end up being turned into some big movie. Wasn't The Matrix one of them? I'm not sure. Definitely The Thing with the Future Crimes. Philip K. Dick wrote that. He had all this stuff about fourth-dimensional universes and philosophy of the nature of existence. Was the Adjustment Bureau one of them? It might have been or it might not. I don't know. I don't know. The best science fiction movies are all based on 3-page short stories written by weird science fiction philosophers in the 1950s in some book. You had all these science fiction authors. They'd all write short stories. The author would usually die before they earned any money from them. And then 50 years later, some science fiction movie fellow would come along and spend 8 billion euros filming Tom Cruise reenacting your 3-paragraph story and you stretch it out to 2 hours. And it'll be great. It'll be absolutely fucking great. Now hopefully your widow and great-grandchildren get some money out of that. Or maybe you think they don't deserve it, in which case, it's not really your business, you're dead. Into your head. Another thing about this room, further to the other stuff that I've mentioned. Now, this might be going in at the beginning of the episode, so don't be put off by the fact that I've started this by saying another thing about this room. That's just a cold open. If you're hearing this at the beginning and you hear me going, another thing about this room, don't worry. It's just further to what's coming up later. It doesn't really matter what order you hear it in, it's fine. Anyway, this room now has a little station at one end of the desk where everything that needs to be charged is charging, and the item that's charging is in a little container that's neatly attached to a wall. And one of the things that's in there is my hair cutting equipment. I keep my hair cutting equipment in here now. So I could arguably, in the middle of a segment here, I could quite easily start cutting my hair. All I need to do is first I'd go over to the ensuite toilet over there, get a towel that's sitting there and wet the towel and then just wet my hair with it a bit. Then I could just come over here, sit right down here where I'm recording, take my hair cutting equipment off the shelf there. It's fully charged and I could just start shaving my head right here as I do this. Now, I'd have to take off this hat. I wear a hat all the time. I'd have to take that off, which would affect my sunlight management arrangements. I suppose that would be okay. But I'd also have to take off these headphones, which I use to hear myself talking. That would be the only off-putting thing for me about that. I'd be quite happy to multitask and cut my hair while I'm recording a podcast here. I just would have to take off the headphones and then, no, I don't like recording without the headphones on. I need to hear what I sound like on these headphones. And then there'd also be the buzzing. The hair cutting equipment is basically a shaver. I think we've all realised that. It's just a shaver. I don't give a load of scissors and things. I'm not a barber. I like to shave my hair with a hair razor. Hair razor. Is that a thing? Hair raising. No. Is hair raising, does that mean you grow hair? Surely it does. Because child rearing is called raising a child. So hair raising wouldn't be cutting your hair, would it? Hair raising. They use hair raising where they're talking about something that's alarming or frightening. They say that's hair raising. Now that means it makes your hair stand up on end, so it scares you. Doesn't mean your hair is growing. Just means your hair is stretching out a bit for a moment and then settling back down. So no, hair raising is different. Anyway, the noise from the razor, that would be a problem because it would either be a problem or it would be a problem by its absence because my noise eliminating setup that sometimes treats my harmonica playing as noise and cuts it out completely may well cut out the noise of the razor completely. And that would be a problem because I'd be sitting here claiming that I'm shaving my hair and not knowing whether you can hear it or not until I listen back. Maybe that wouldn't be a problem. Maybe that would just add to the entertainment in some way. Not going to do it today, though. Not going to do it today. I think the most off-putting part of it for me, though, would be to have to take my headphones off. Usually when I cut my hair, I'm listening to podcasts in one ear. But that's earphones. That's different from the headphones I'm listening to myself on now. No, I'm not sure I'd be cutting my hair while talking into this microphone here. Well, there are other things I can do in here involving multitasking as well. There's a bed in here now, a proper bed. So if I wanted to multitask, I could also rest while doing this. I couldn't go asleep. I'd have to be awake for this. And I probably wouldn't be able to go asleep anyway after all these energy drinks. But I could lie down and rest my skeleton, rest my bones and my muscles. Just not my brain. My brain would have to stay active. If I was ordered into bed rest by a doctor because I'd broken my leg or something, I could do that while recording. I think we're approaching the end of today's episode of Into Your Head Podcast Dubai. Now don't stop it yet. Don't stop and move on to the next thing yet. It's not finished. If you have arrived at your workplace or wherever you're going while you're listening to this, then by all means pause this and listen to the rest of it on your return journey. But don't skip on to whatever's next on your queue. By the way, I'm not suggesting you mitch off work for the day to listen to this. No, you can finish on your way home. You can listen in both directions. Everything doesn't have to be exactly the right length for your morning commute. People obsess over this. They think, oh, my morning commute in my car is 40 minutes, therefore I will only listen to podcasts that are exactly 40 minutes long. Other ones are too long. There's no way I can break that up. No, it has to be exactly 40 minutes. Otherwise, it's unlistenable. If you're doing that or something, there's something you're wrong about. Don't be doing that. Relax. You're allowed to stop mid-program and resume it later on your way home. In fact, when you resume it on your way home, you'll probably be in better spirits to enjoy this. You'll be in a good mood. Oh, my day is over. I'm on my way home. Unless, of course, your home is terrible and you think of work as your only escape from that hideous family of yours. Well, you can listen to this at home as well, you know. That's the thing. That's the thing, you know. You can listen to podcasts at home. You don't have to be in a car or on a bus or walking to work to listen to podcasts. You do not. It's absolute nonsense. You can listen to shit 24/7 if you want. You can put this in your ear. Put it in one ear. As long as you're not crossing the road or something. Put this in one ear and then have your other ear available for the rest of the world in case anyone has anything worth saying to you that's not in a podcast, because that can happen. You can't rely solely on podcasts for your only input. That's like thinking vitamins can be your main meal. No, you have to have proper food as well. Have vitamins in one ear and McDonald's double cheeseburger meal with Coca-Cola Zero and one of those weird ice cream things they do. Well, it's not that weird. It's ice cream in a tub and the other ear, I suppose. And you might think that's a bit of an imbalance. Oh, I suppose. They talk about having balanced meals. No, have a meal that's completely imbalanced, but then have another meal that's the opposite of it in the other ear. I don't mean in terms of food. I mean, listen to me in one ear, listen to other things in the other ear from the real world. That's balance. That's balance. It's not always about food, you know. You intake other things other than food during your day. You intake this. This is good for you. What I'm doing here, what you're listening to. You may or may not realize it, but this is good for you. You're listening to something that isn't someone telling you the world is going to shit in a handbasket. Because every other media, some fella sits looking into a camera and he says, "Hello, the world is going to hell in a handbasket." Is a handbasket her handbasket? A handbasket, presumably, is what you have in a hot air balloon. There's a hang glider. Hang gliders don't have baskets. So they should call the balloon a... Oh, that's irrelevant. Anyway, I presume a hand basket is a thing you carry. Well, all baskets are like that, aren't they? Are all baskets not like that? I don't know. Maybe it's a hang basket, like those things people put their plants into outside their front doors. Because they think, oh no, I'm not planting things in the ground. That's gross. The ground is gross and disgusting. I don't want things growing in, especially not beautiful flowers. I want my beautiful flowers to be hanging suspended several feet above the earth in a basket that's probably made out of the stems of other flowers that have been flash frozen or whatever you do to wood to turn it into a basket. I don't know. Do you freeze wood? Is that how it works? Or do you preserve it the same way they preserve dead bodies or something? I don't know. Do they mummify? What happens to wood to turn it into something that's not rotting in the ground in the forest and that you can put in your home? I never understood that. You have a coffee table in front of you. For one thing, that coffee table is very rarely the shape of a tree trunk or a tree branch. There's no tree branch that's that wide that you can just cut out a coffee table out of that and just slice away at the tree trunk and just have a whole production line of coffee tables coming out of that. No, I never understood that. You have things that can't possibly have come out of the shape of a tree trunk, but we're told they're wood. They don't rot, so presumably they either mummify them or do some sort of dry freezing or something. I don't know what they do. Even when you flash freeze peas from the garden, they eventually fall apart. That coffee table, you expect that to last decades if you look after it. It's the last coffee table we had. I think it lasted about 10 years. And it was only after 10 years that the cat's funny managed to scratch through most of the leg. Even then, it was still pretty much usable. You just get a cat scratching thing. You wrap it around the leg, covers up all the damage, and then it's great. So no, I don't know. I don't know is what I'm saying. I don't know. Anyway, I think that's the end of the program. Goodbye.